Chapter 18. Exposure. At the end of May 2013, a young computer programmer called Ladar Levison found a business card on his door in Dallas. On it was a number and a message asking him to call. That led to a visit from the FBI. Levison was one of the successors of the cypherpunks, like Phil Zimmerman, who had created the PGP encryption system in the 1990s. Levison had built his own secure email service called LavaBit, which used encryption to keep messages away from prying eyes. Now the FBI were very interested in one of his users. Levison knew that all kinds of people with varying motives were attracted to a service that guaranteed anonymity, but it was a principle he believed in. The definition of bad guys is certainly a relative term that changes over time. Levison argues in response to the idea that those with malicious intent gravitated towards his system. You know, back during the American Revolution, the American revolutionaries were referred to as terrorists by the British. That was the language of a man unafraid of taking on the state. Levison is barred from confirming whose email the authorities were interested in. One of his users had created an account with the address cincinnatus@lavabit.com. The first part of the address referred to a statesman who had chosen to relinquish authoritarian powers once he had used them to defend Rome. The FBI seemed to know something was up, but how much did they know? The power of encryption was still strong enough to require them to approach Levison for the keys to unlock the messages they were interested in. That email account had mysteriously summoned a group of journalists to Hong Kong, where they arrived as May turned to June. They found a man, much younger than they had expected, toying with a Rubik's Cube in a hotel lobby, an old-fashioned recognition signal that was more out of a Cold War spy novel than the modern techno-age. As they spoke to him, the journalists learned that the man passionately espoused a worldview that epitomized the way in which computers and the internet had become an indispensable part of the lives of some members of a new generation. "The internet allowed me to experience freedom and explore my full capacity as a human being," he told them. "For many kids, the internet is a means of self-actualization. It allows them to explore who they are and who they want to be. But that works only if we're able to be private and anonymous, to make mistakes without them following us. I worry that mine was the last generation to enjoy that freedom," he told his visitors. That belief had driven him to betray the place where he worked and challenge the power that the state had built. "For me, it all comes down to state power against the people's ability to meaningfully oppose that power." On the 5th of June, General Keith Alexander was, perhaps ironically, given what was coming, in Germany meeting with allies when he received news that a story was about to break. Alexander later said that the NSA had no idea where it had come from. Within a few hours, the story had appeared in The Guardian. It published a court order to the company Verizon that demanded that it hand over details of every phone call in America, the program created after 9/11. The revelation that the NSA was collecting domestic information which included that of everyone in the country was so stunning and so out of the blue that at first it was met with an eerie silence in the wider world, like that in the moments after a bomb blast, as everyone struggled to understand what had just happened. In Cheltenham, Ian Lobban, director of GCHQ, was a worried man. "When I heard the news," he later said, "I lay awake saying to myself, I hope this isn't a Brit." He even went round colleagues in the donut to ask if there was anyone in their teams who had taken an unusually long holiday and who might be the culprit. He thought an employee gone rogue would have been spotted in the much smaller, more tightly knit British community, but he knew that if he was wrong and that was the case, the results would be disastrous, not least for himself. "That would have been the end of me," he later told a journalist. In London, a few hours after the story first broke, Britain's Intelligence and Security Committee was holding a previously scheduled press conference to publish a report on foreign involvement in the critical national infrastructure. The title was a little misleading because it was really only about the involvement of one company, the Chinese telecoms giant Huawei, in Britain's communications. It examined how that had come to pass without what the committee thought was sufficient oversight, and looked at whether its presence created risks of Chinese espionage against the UK. The next day, the PRISM program was exposed to the world, initially misinterpreted as some kind of secret hack into tech companies' systems. The companies responded by saying they had never heard of such a program, technically true since the code name was classified, and stressed in carefully worded statements that they simply abided by the law. By now, the counterintelligence people at the NSA knew who was behind the stories, but what they did not realize was that the rest of the world was also only a few days from finding out as well. As the shockwaves of the PRISM story began to ripple out in government, in public, and the technology sector, President Obama was making last-minute preparations for one of the most important summits of his presidency to date. At the 200-acre Sunnylands Ranch in California, he was due to meet the new premier of China. It was the moment a coordinated U.S. campaign to corner Beijing over cyber espionage, encompassing the revelations by Mandiant about PLA Unit 61398 hacking American companies, was supposed to reach its crescendo as America's president sat down with China's leader and told him it was time to stop. "We were spring-loaded," one former U.S. intelligence chief said of that moment. But hours before the summit opened, a top-secret document was published which outlined America's doctrine for its own offensive cyber operations. Along with PRISM, it made it all too easy for the Chinese to ask who was really the most aggressive player in cyberspace. The plan to pressure Beijing fizzled out. Within hours of the summit wrapping up, the mystery of who was behind the revelations was over. On Sunday, the 9th of June, Edward Snowden went public to identify himself in an interview recorded in a hotel in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory of Hong Kong. As if trapped in a Jason Bourne film, he warned darkly that the CIA might subject him to rendition, or they might pay the triad gangs of Hong Kong to come after him. Why had he done it? "I do not want to live in a world where everything I do and say is recorded," he explained. The next day, Ladar Levison received a court order demanding he hand over details of the email account the FBI had been interested in. A 6-week legal battle ensued. Levison resisted because he said that handing over the encryption keys would compromise the accounts of all his users. When he was forced to comply, he did it in his own way. He handed over the keys, not on a CD or USB stick or via email, but in an envelope written out in tiny 4-point type on paper. Each of the 5 keychains contained 2,576 characters, making up 11 almost totally illegible pages. "I was giving them exactly what they asked for. They just didn't know what to do with it." The FBI agent dutifully wrote out a receipt for one sealed white envelope. Levison knew that the FBI would have to input the thousands of characters by hand. One mistake would render the whole enterprise meaningless, and that gave him time to shut down his entire system and wipe all the data. He had named each of his servers after his ex-girlfriends and so pulled the plug on one relationship after another. Levison does not see the NSA as the enemy. He is happy for them to protect his country against foreign threats and spy on foreign governments. But he knew which side he was on in the new round of the crypto wars. "In the same way I don't think police should be rolling through our streets in tanks, I don't believe a military organization with the capabilities of the National Security Agency should be spying on its own citizens," he argues. 7 months earlier, Edward Snowden had used his LavaBit email account to organize a crypto party in an art space at the back of a Hawaiian furniture store. These parties are grassroots gatherings in which volunteers teach interested people how to use advanced encryption, like PGP and Tor, to protect their communications. Attendees at that December 2012 event recalled that the quiet young man introduced himself as Ed, but seemed reluctant to tell people where he worked. That was because his workplace was an NSA base called Kunia, originally a massive bunker underneath a pineapple field built after Pearl Harbor, later a warehouse for torpedoes before it finally became an NSA facility. Snowden had taken a job in Hawaii with a pay cut to get access to the final trove of secret documents that he wanted. In the Cold War, spy agencies always dreamt of recruiting a code clerk because all the traffic of an embassy passed through their hands as they encoded it to be sent. The modern equivalent in the computer world is a systems administrator involved in maintaining computer networks. As far back as 1991, the NSA had recognized that these individuals' unique access to classified material made them a top target for foreign intelligence agencies, since they could so easily, so quickly, so undetectably steal vast quantities of information. However, for all the effort it made in getting inside other people's systems, the NSA seems to have been slow to think about securing its own from within. In his final job choices, Snowden may have sought maximum access to damaging information, but attempts to push his story into that familiar Cold War notion of espionage do not quite fit. He may have received sanctuary and help from other states after he fled, but no evidence has been produced to prove that he was acting out of anything other than his own deeply held ideological beliefs when he made his decision to reveal the NSA and GCHQ's secrets. He was, as one NSA person puts it, self-radicalized. Snowden was of a generation for whom computers were not just machines in the office you worked in, but things through which you lived your life and interacted with people, sharing intimate details with friends and building relationships. Snowden also valued anonymity. Web postings would emerge in which he used that anonymity to express himself and his political views in a trenchant manner, which suggested he felt he could take on a different identity online. He also explained to the journalists that he had learned from video games the importance of individual protagonists fighting against powerful forces. Snowden was from a different generation from the Haydens and the Alexanders, for whom computers were simply a tool for their work. Computers were his world. Snowden was himself an exemplar of how computers had changed spying. Spy agencies needed people with his skills for the new world of espionage, not martini-swilling Aston Martin-driving James Bonds who could navigate a casino, but Diet Coke-drinking hackers who knew their way round a network. Older managers struggled to relate to these new recruits, who in turn were often contemptuous of the lack of technical knowledge of their seniors. And it should be little surprise that one or two of these hackers may have infused the libertarian ideology of the cypherpunks, who believed information needed to be free and, at the further end of the spectrum, believed government could be the enemy of liberty. Barack Obama fought to keep his BlackBerry when he assumed the presidency, rather than have the security officials take it away. But to Snowden's disappointment, the new president seemed to heed his securocrat's advice when it came to keeping the intelligence programs he was inheriting from George W. Bush. After taking office, Obama continued with the bulk data program, especially after Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab nearly blew up a plane with a bomb in his underwear on Christmas Day 2009. That highlighted the political dangers of being seen once again to have failed to connect the dots. The persistence of these programs led to further disillusionment from Snowden, who says a final breaking point came when he saw Director of National Intelligence James Clapper deny to Congress that the NSA was collecting data on Americans. Clapper would later apologize for this after the details of the phone metadata program were revealed. Snowden, like Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, who downloaded a mass of State Department and Pentagon files and gave them to Julian Assange's WikiLeaks website a few years earlier, highlighted two truths. First, that the U.S. secret state had grown so large that it had lost the ability to keep its own secrets. Around 1.5 million people had top security clearances, and many worked as contractors, part of the military cyber complex. Snowden himself worked for a private company, but said he was tasked by the NSA. The emphasis on sharing, post-9/11, to connect the dots, had provided too many people too much access to too many secrets. The other truth was, as every spy agency had learned, that it had become a lot easier to gather and exfiltrate a ton of secret material. Manning transferred diplomatic cables onto a CD while pretending he was listening to music by Lady Gaga. Snowden was a touch more sophisticated, using accumulated passwords and special privileges to scrape all the files he could get hold of. No one is quite sure how many he took. Perhaps over a million, some claimed. Britain thought at least 58,000 of its GCHQ files that had been accessible to the NSA. For an organization whose raison d'etre is secrets, the NSA had failed when it came to protecting its own. Snowden argued that the data collection and programs instituted after 9/11 constituted a threat to privacy. Every time you pick up the phone, dial a number, write an email, make a purchase, travel on the bus carrying a cell phone, swipe a card somewhere, you leave a trace and the government has decided that it's a good idea to collect it all, everything, even if you've never been suspected of any crime, he said. He also argued that the danger was that a capability so powerful, and which had also been secret, could in the future be turned on the population without them knowing. The NSA is surely not the Stasi, Snowden told Time magazine in reference to the East German Security Service. But we should always remember that the danger to societies from security services is not that they will spontaneously decide to embrace mustache twirling and jackboots to bear us bodily into dark places, but that the slowly shifting foundation of policy will make it such that mustaches and jackboots are discovered to prove an operational advantage toward a necessary purpose. A powerful capability had grown up, and it had grown up in secret. But was it actually being misused to spy on ordinary people? Snowden and his supporters argued it was. Supporters of the NSA argued it was not. The agency said that over the previous 10 years, there had only been 12 cases of intentional misuse, such as people looking for information on current and former partners, for instance, when an NSA employee owned up to looking at her husband's phone calls because she suspected he was being unfaithful. GCHQ in 2014 also sacked one employee for gross misconduct after unauthorized searches, but said this was the first such case. But Snowden and his supporters argued that the act of gathering up everyone's data to be processed by machines was itself an intrusion into privacy. The abuse doesn't occur when people look at the data. It occurs when people gather the data in the first place. This goes to a fundamental question of what constitutes privacy in the digital age. Does the bulk collection of data and its analysis by computers constitute spying and surveillance? Back in the pre-computer First World War, the task of censoring the post had been undertaken by hand. Each examiner read on average 110 private letters each day. Even an official report acknowledged the distastefulness of this. No one employed in the work could fail to experience an involuntary and deep-seated disgust when he first broke the seal of an unknown person's correspondence, it noted. The knowledge of surveillance also created a kind of self-censorship. Men and women have been oppressed when writing by the fear of the unknown eyes that would scan their correspondence. They have feared to put their correspondences on paper, have felt a not unnatural dislike to utter their true desires and their genuine feelings, the internal official history of postal censorship recorded. It called the practice a tolerable evil. But is a computer collecting and reading your email the same kind of intrusion? The spies maintain it is not, but realize they may have made a mistake by not making their case before it was exposed. Government should, long ago, have explained that meeting legitimate demands for digital intelligence for law enforcement, as well as for their main national security mission, means bulk access to the Internet, argues former GCHQ director Sir David Omond. Our communications do all already pass through many computers in the course of their delivery, just as all our financial transactions pass through the bank's audit systems. Computers are not conscious, and I do not think we should worry that these intimate details of ours are subject to the security algorithms. Privacy activists questioned many of the specific details of what was revealed, the adequacy of legal authorizations, the rules for sharing intelligence, the rigor of oversight process, the weaker controls over metadata and for foreign intelligence compared to domestic. But they also maintain that the act of gathering up communications and then having computers filtering them en masse is in itself a violation of privacy. They argue the new systems represent a fundamental shift in the relationship between the individual and the state, which will lead people to alter behavior and self-censor, to become more conformist and be afraid of experimenting, for fear it will be recorded and be accessible in the future. They believe a shift towards identifiability online will add surveillance that crushes dissenting voices and lead to control or self-censorship to reinforce existing power structures. The privacy activists' argument necessarily challenges not just the state, but also technology corporations who carry out similar automated collecting and scanning, and also the whole future of big data analysis. One of the main differences is that you can opt out of Google, but not GCHQ. The question therefore becomes whether GCHQ's use of data is necessary, proportionate, and effective in supporting national security rather than selling advertising to justify its employment. All spying is invasive of someone's privacy. Its point is finding out something that someone else wants to keep secret. In that sense, it always raises ethical issues. Some oppose it entirely, but most believe it comes down to the details of who is being spied on and why and with what controls over the spy's behavior. Judging how much spying you want relates to how far you balance the need for security and the cost of privacy. That may change over time as different security threats emerge. But it is also ultimately a personal judgment. It is one that in democratic societies, unlike authoritarian ones, can be subject to debate. Snowden's supporters argued that he did a public service by kick-starting that debate. His critics contend that the way he did so damaged security. The sudden revelation of huge capabilities, and on the terms of the agency's critics, left GCHQ and the NSA reeling. Senior officials acknowledged they could have been more transparent in the past, and that perhaps even programs like the U.S. gathering of domestic call metadata might have been able to withstand the light of day, but no one had tried. GCHQ argued that the issue of what could be done with the capability was confused with what it was actually being used for. However, the organization had barely moved beyond the reflexive position of total secrecy it had inherited from Bletchley Park. The vacuum of information was filled by critics who claimed it was spying on ordinary people. A panel of judges found that the collection system did not breach human rights, but that there had been a lack of failure over the specific issue of a lack of transparency in how it worked and what safeguards operated. GCHQ maintained it was simply doing what it had been tasked to do by the government under the law, and that it had contributed to saving many lives in stopping terrorist attacks, although a 2015 oversight report redacted all the details of how bulk collection may have actually made a difference. Staff were left bruised. We don't employ the type of people who would be prepared to intrude into the private lives of ordinary people, Sir Ian Lobban told an oversight committee in a 2013 hearing of British spy chiefs, which was televised for the first time. If they were asked to snoop, I wouldn't have the workforce. They'd leave the building. He echoed that claim in his departing speech. We don't suddenly lose our souls the moment we swipe into the donut, he said. What was clear was that the old days in which signals intelligence was the most secret part of the secret world was passing. This was beginning anyway in a world in which computers and surveillance and large-scale data processing had moved well beyond the purview of spies alone and overlapped with the private sector and cyber security. But now the spies were going to have to come to terms with living and working in a very different environment, one that David Cameron christened Living in Snowdonia. In the US, there was a more heated reaction, partly because of the stronger libertarian streak that encompassed both the left and right of the political spectrum. There was also more debate over the utility of the programs. Supporters said they were vital. I can't think of any terrorist investigation where the NSA was not a preeminent or central player, Michael Leiter, who ran the U.S. National Counterterrorism Center, said. The harder question is the extent to which the specific new bulk analysis powers acquired after 9/11 were more valuable than the traditional route of intercepting the specific communications of a target. Talk of more than 50 plots having been stopped using call data was challenged and downgraded. Those examining the details have said they have found evidence that PRISM had been considerably more useful than domestic call metadata collection, pointing, for instance, to a case in which PRISM targeted the email address of an Al-Qaeda courier in Pakistan. This led to emails being intercepted from an individual in the US urgently seeking advice on mixing explosives. The individual, Najibullah Zazi, was then put under intensive FBI surveillance and eventually convicted. The issue of the proportionality and effectiveness of bulk access and data mining is hard to judge from the outside, since so much is secret. Supporters say it was highly classified for a reason. If the person you are trying to find knows you can do this, and if they know the parameters you use to try and find patterns and signatures of behavior, then they will change the way they operate in order to minimize their chances of being spotted. Privacy activists contend that this argument has allowed the state to expand its intrusive powers without sufficient public understanding or accountability, and that what was created was disproportionate to the threat. Judging the impact of secret intelligence is always challenging, leaving critics asking for proof and supporters maintaining that secrets need to stay secret to be effective. That problem also related to the debate over the damage caused by Snowden's disclosures. Intelligence officials in the US and UK maintain that Snowden did real damage to intelligence gathering capabilities. They say he heightened awareness of communications security issues among their targets, leading them to change their behavior. They say they saw advice going round those they were monitoring, telling them to change communications providers, most likely away from American companies, or switch encryption systems, although some observers reckon these may now be easier to crack. They claim coverage of their targets was lost. Those who worked inside the agencies say they watched sources go dark. Privacy activists remain skeptical. Officials also said they had to work on the assumption that other states had got access to Snowden's documents. They focus on the fact that Snowden had found refuge first in China and then in Russia, the two countries most eager to understand Western technical capabilities, neither of which, ironically, are proponents of the kind of internet freedom that Snowden himself espouses. Not even the KGB in the heyday of Philby, Burgess and MacLean in the 1950s could have dreamt of acquiring 58,000 highly classified intelligence documents, said Sir David Omond. Snowden and his supporters reply that there is no evidence that these states have got access to the material, and say steps were taken to prevent that by ensuring Snowden himself was no longer able to provide the keys. He's a smart fellow, Chris Inglis, deputy director of the NSA until early 2014, has said of Snowden. He knows something about security and encryption, but what we have determined over 70 years of cryptologic history is that single minds never prevail against a diverse set of minds. The idea that a single person could secure information against the dedicated efforts of intelligence services that are quite capable is asking a lot. There's some amount of hubris in that. The Snowden revelation seemed shocking because, while most people know that spies spy, few had given much thought as to how they might do that in the digital world, and thought about whom they might spy on. And it was not just on terrorists. The counter-terrorist mission had become the overt justification for modern intelligence gathering, but the traditional mission of securing national advantage remained. This might mean collecting intelligence on other states, or issues like the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. It might mean using intelligence to answer questions such as, who gave the orders when Syria fired chemical weapons in 2013, or when a missile shot down a Malaysian airliner over Ukraine in 2014? But securing national advantage can also mean spying on those closer to you. This is what Britain did in the First World War when it intercepted American diplomatic traffic to obtain the Zimmermann telegram from Germany's foreign minister. Countries know this happens, but the first rule of espionage is don't get caught. And thanks to Snowden, the US and UK got caught. International bodies like the UN, IAEA and EU had been targeted both by old-fashioned bugging of offices as well as getting inside computer networks. At one point in 2011, the NSA stumbled upon the Chinese, who were also spying within the United Nations. Spying on allies has been normal practice within Europe for many years, including ahead of major European summits. Breaking French codes was a priority when Britain was trying to join Europe decades ago, and more recently MI6 provided intelligence to policymakers ahead of every major treaty negotiation during the 1990s, as the French did against Britain. NSA officials maintain they do not conduct commercial espionage in the way the Chinese do, stealing information from foreign companies to give to domestic companies. But the NSA does conduct economic espionage. This may involve spying on companies for national security reasons, for instance, to see if they are breaking sanctions or selling items for use in a country like Iran's nuclear program. It might involve spying on Gazprom, because the company is closely aligned with Russia's national security policy, which can use energy as a tool to squeeze other states. But economic espionage may also involve spying on companies and countries for economic gain on a national level. American officials argue that spying on Japan's trade position for the benefit of the U.S. government in its negotiations is not the same as stealing secrets from a Japanese company and giving them direct to a U.S. company. But not everyone may accept the distinctions. Countries responded differently to the revelations based on their own history and culture, including the US and UK. Brits tend to trust their government and mistrust their corporations. Americans tend to mistrust their government and trust their corporations, Sir Tim Berners-Lee said of the differing reactions. Distinctions were also evident in Europe. France has always been more laid back about espionage and state power. Perhaps the idea of America stealing French secrets made for less fuss, since the French elite knew they'd do pretty much the same thing to the Americans. France is also reported to carry out the kind of bulk collection that the US undertakes, sucking up international metadata flowing between France and abroad, and is reported to have similar arrangements with some of its telecoms and technology companies to provide bulk access through Mediterranean cables. What is different is the sheer size of the US capability and its ability to exploit control over the infrastructure and the dominance of their companies at every level. They have wiretapped the entire world, one former French spy argues enviously. When the Chinese try to steal information from our servers, we can spot and block them because they use hacker methods. However, the United States does not need to hack us because it controls the Internet. It is at the heart of the network. In Germany, the legacy of the Gestapo and the Stasi makes espionage a toxic and emotive subject, in stark contrast to the British reference point of Bletchley Park. Mass surveillance based on human informers is something many in East Germany can remember in their own lifetimes. You know, for us, this would have been a dream come true, a former member of the Stasi said of the revelations, pointing out that in his day, only 40 telephones could be tapped at one time because of a lack of equipment. An interest in economic and financial stability earned Germany a ranking of 3 out of 5 on the NSA scale of interest, with China, Russia, Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan rating a 1. Chancellor Angela Merkel had been targeted by the NSA perhaps as far back as 2002, one of around 35 world leaders. But Germany is both a target and a partner. As well as being spied on, it also seems to provide bulk access to the NSA. Both German and American officials say cooperation on counter-terrorism surveillance has helped stop terrorist plots in Germany. If the NSA were to provide us with no more information, it would be a disaster for us, a German intelligence officer told Die Welt as the Snowden affair began. This dual aspect of being a target and a partner reflects the tension in international operations like finding terrorists who cross borders, dealing with the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, or supporting a joint military engagement in Afghanistan, and the more traditional espionage missions involved in securing national advantage by spying on the diplomatic or trade talks of the same countries you are cooperating with in other fields. France was also both a target and a partner, with reports that it had passed NSA information from undersea cables which carried traffic from Asia and Afghanistan in exchange for intelligence about parts of the world where France has little visibility. Israel likewise partners America against Iran's nuclear program, but still spies on American foreign policy. The Germans pushed to have a deal similar to the one Britain enjoys with the US, which would limit spying. Negotiations began, but one report says the Germans blanched when they were told that in return for joining the club, they would have to take on responsibility for intelligence collection and cyber operations in certain parts of the world, a sign of just how the Five Eyes really works. It was telling that Snowden had spent his spare time in Hawaii organizing a crypto party. His revelations reignited the crypto wars that had started in the 1970s with a blazing intensity. In the 1990s, we left the intelligence agencies abandoning hopes of stopping the spread of public key encryption. And so, as the 21st century began, many people thought that code making had reached ascendancy over code breaking, and those who had sought to get inside secure communications had simply given up in the face of the power of encryption. But, as they always try to do, spies found new ways to reach their targets. Cryptanalysis, using supercomputers and people to break codes, had remained a core part of the mission. It is costly in terms of time and resources, however, both for the few human brains capable of working out possible attacks and for the vast supercomputers. That cost, and the challenge of public key and the like, has meant that spy agencies have had to look for ways around encryption rather than face it head-on in order to gain access to communications. There are a number of possibilities. Domestically, a court order to a communications provider might work to get the keys to a message. In Britain, after the crypto wars were lost in the 1990s, the government included a provision in the 2000 Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act that allowed law enforcement to demand keys from people. Lawful interception was easy when people simply used UK or US phone companies, but once they started using international internet firms to communicate, then it became much harder. Prism was particularly valued since it provided a means of getting hold of foreign encrypted communications from a US-based provider without having to intercept and decrypt the messages. But other countries like China increasingly also began to demand keys and access to American technology products for their law enforcement, a move met with horror, including by the US government, who had demanded the same thing themselves. If getting the keys through the front door was not possible, then sometimes you might hope to pick up a message through the intelligence machine, which provides only partial rather than total access. But what if a message you intercepted was encrypted? One of the most controversial revelations from Snowden's cache was the claim that the agencies had undermined encryption. Precisely because modern encryption is commercial, it offers spies opportunities. They can get inside the process of code-making in a way they could not have done in the past, the equivalent of having influence on the design of Enigma machines. That might be very useful, not just in understanding the workings of a machine, but also in messing with its settings to reduce the randomness. There were reports of a $250 million campaign to influence, as well as overtly leverage, commercial product designs through sensitive relationships with industry partners. This included, it was reported, work to insert vulnerabilities into commercial encryption systems, which make them exploitable, in other words, trapdoors, following on from covert work in the Cold War. In an echo of Diffie and Hellman's battle in the 1970s, there were claims that the NSA had influenced an international random number generator standard. The standard was eventually withdrawn. If a random number is not quite as random as you thought, then knowing the weakness might allow you to crack it. The fundamental tension of the crypto wars remains, but it is now writ large by the spread of communications and computing and the desire to protect the growing pile of personal data. In the days of Bletchley Park, Alan Turing's and his colleagues' battle against encryption was waged against custom-built systems like Enigma, used almost exclusively by enemy armed forces. By the 70s, encryption was starting to spread to large companies and institutions. Next, in the 90s, to determined individuals, including criminals. But now, modern encryption is commercially available for everyone to use. So deliberately weakening, or more subtly, failing to point out a weakness, has a much broader impact. This creates far more complicated quandaries in the relative balance between offense and defense. The public may want spies to be able to read the messages of those who wish to do them harm, but what if those same systems are used to protect innocent people's personal information from criminals and other states? The tension applies not just to encryption, but to all forms of computer vulnerabilities. What the spies call the equities problem, balancing offense and defense, becomes acute. Should inadvertent weaknesses in computers and communications be patched up to protect or left open to spy? It is false to imagine or say that NSA broadly has the capability to decrypt most of the encryption used by any citizens in the world, but in particularly US citizens, to access their web browsers or financial systems or things of that sort, says Chris Inglis. He argues that the US finds ways of keeping US citizens' communications safe while exploiting those of adversaries. We do, in fact, find ways to do precisely that, he says, while avoiding specific detail. In practice, this may parallel the system developed from the first battles in the crypto wars, in which focus is placed on exported systems, although the distinction is harder now, and in which trapdoors are well hidden. Critics claim that this position is a dangerously arrogant one. Who is to say that not just China or Russia, with their crypt analytical expertise, but soon perhaps the most advanced hackers and criminals, will be able to find and exploit the weaknesses? "We are not dumb enough to think we are the smartest kid on the block," is all one American official will say, but critics charge that too little emphasis has been placed on defense. The revelations about encryption were a 9/11 moment for those involved in computer security outside of government, says Ross Anderson of Cambridge University. This was not because they were surprised by what the spies were trying to do, but by the sheer scale of it. Although naming programs to defeat encryption after battles in your country's respective civil wars perhaps did not help. Bull Run for the NSA and Edge Hill for GCHQ. Systems like Tor, which provided anonymity online, were also targeted to try to understand who might be using them. "They've pushed it even further than we thought they would," Anderson argues. "The surprising thing to us was that there appear to have been occasional pockets of competence within NSA and GCHQ. Many of us had for many years thought that the real secret was that, like other public sector IT projects, it didn't work and there was really nobody there. But to find they had built this machine and got it working was an eye-opener." This is true of much of what Edward Snowden revealed. No one who thought about it should have been surprised that code-breaking communications intelligence agencies tried to break codes or collect communications. The surprise was not the attempt, but the success and scale of what they achieved. The details were surprising. The sheer magnitude of the programs was surprising. The amount of money, the effort, how broad they were, says Bruce Schneier, who examined some of the Snowden cache. "Because we never really thought about the details that much. So while not a lot was surprising, in the end, a lot of it was surprising." Until they appeared all over the internet and on the front pages of the newspapers, these capabilities to target encryption were among the most closely guarded secrets. "Do not ask about or speculate on sources or methods underpinning Bull Run," one document instructs the reader. These capabilities are among the SIGINT community's most fragile, and the inadvertent disclosure of the simple fact of could alert the adversary and result in immediate loss of the capability, a GCHQ document said, echoing the Bletchley fear of opponents abandoning a system they had thought secure. "Always look for plain text," was one of NSA veteran Robert Morris's golden rules, meaning that rather than break the code of a message, find a place along its path where it was not encrypted. The Tempest attacks of the Cold War, picking up electromagnetic signals, were one way of getting hold of text as it was typed into a machine and before it was encoded. Today, there are modern methods. These include what are called side-channel attacks, for instance, analyzing the amount of power consumed by a computer making its code to work out the setting. And if you were really desperate, there was always the oldest technique of all, human spies. Agents could be run within the telecoms industry or a company to compromise a system or an individual account. Another example of how human and electronic intelligence can be interwoven. Why expend all the energy of a supercomputer to try to break in if you can bribe your way in? This might mean a black bag job, breaking into a foreign embassy or mission in Washington, New York, or London, or it might mean physically intercepting an encryption machine being sent to a foreign capital and inserting a weakness or backdoor into it that can be exploited. Computer servers and routers being sent abroad were also intercepted en route and redirected to a secret location where implants could be installed. Computer espionage, hacking, offers the other way around even the most advanced encryption by targeting the endpoint. In other words, someone's computer where the clear text of a message is first written before being encrypted or read after it is decrypted, and where data is stored. Just as China might place an implant in a Tibetan activist's computer to act as a spy, so the US and UK could do the same. In the NSA, the emergence of fiber optic cables and encryption in the 90s is believed to have led directly to increased funding to support a new emphasis on hacking into computers to gather data which might otherwise be harder to access. This activity was undertaken by the Office of Tailored Access Operations, TAO, formed in 1997. In the early days, TAO used to be just a bunch of hackers, one member of the department wrote in 2012. We did things in a more ad hoc manner. One guy did it all. Now we're more systematic. TAO now consists of separate teams for each target, one looking at China and North Korea together, another Iran, another Russia, as well as cyber counterintelligence and counterterrorism. In the teams are developers to create software and hardware tools alongside analysts who plan operations. A planner would take an operation to a mission director who would assess the risks and then finally, if approved, hand it to the elite team of hackers in the Remote Operations Center, ROC. In 2004 to 2005, the hacking team expanded rapidly into a 40,000-square-foot office housing 215 personnel able to undertake at least 100 operations a day. What if your job was to exploit a target's computer, collect voice cuts from an adversary's phone system, use a terrorist's web-based email account to infect them with a Trojan horse, and assist the military in locating a high-value terrorist target for capture? All in a day's work? Then you would be working in the Remote Operations Center, an internal 2006 note explains. ROC's role at the time was described as to collect data, geolocate individuals, provide real-time support in rendition of high-profile terrorists, and manage a global covert infrastructure. Their motto was, "Your data is our data, your equipment is our equipment. Anytime, any place, by any legal means." These U.S. teams had been getting into Chinese systems from the late 1990s and into those of Al-Qaeda in Iraq from 2004, according to reports. They sometimes work in real time, waiting for a target to go online, which might be in the middle of the night, and then moving fast. We try to grab all of it for analysis later. We don't take time during the operation to sort out the good from the bad, a hacker noted. The NSA is a place, insiders claim, in which a military organization values its geeks. There are plenty of people with pink and blue hair, one NSA official explains, using his slightly dismissive shorthand for counterculture hacker colleagues. One likes to go round the offices on a skateboard, another on a unicycle, juggling while he rides. When they are testing the government's own systems, they are told to spend $1,000 on software and are then put in a room with Twinkies and Red Bull. 100% of the time they get into their targets, it is claimed, even without using NSA techniques. And 98% of the time the other side does not know it. That is because it is not the tools but the knowledge that counts. The NSA needed hackers, and its staff went around their conventions donning black T-shirts and handing out business cards to recruit them. TAO has developed a vast array of spy equipment, the modern technical equivalent of the kind of things that Q gave James Bond in the films. Catalogues which have been leaked show that this ranges from rigged computer monitor cables which allow TAO to see what is displayed, to modified USB sticks which can send data via radio links. Designers have thought about every which way to get into modern technology. What I took away from reading the Snowden documents was that if the NSA wants into your computer, it's in, period, says cryptographer Bruce Schneier. Initially, computers had been targeted in the same way as traditional hackers, for instance through emails. But increasingly, the NSA and GCHQ used more sophisticated techniques by getting in through the infrastructure, for instance, through a compromised router which directs traffic around the Internet, and fooling the computer to send it to a fake site owned by the NSA or GCHQ, at which malware can be installed in order to take control of the computer. In 2009, researchers who had attended an international scientific conference were sent a CD after they arrived home, The CD contained pictures and materials, but also malware. This appears to have been inserted onto the disk when it was intercepted en route to its destination. The team at Kaspersky Lab would find that the group behind the spying operation, whom they called Equation, were operating as far back as 1996 and had targeted 42 countries, including Iran, Russia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, Syria, and Mali, topping the list. Although not directly named, the NSA was widely suspected as the culprit, not least because this was judged to be the most sophisticated attack seen, getting deep inside computer systems, including the hardware. Kaspersky's discovery also indicated how even the act of spy hunting has now been outsourced to private firms. The scale, as well as sophistication of cyber espionage, had grown. According to leaked documents, by the end of 2013, the NSA's aspiration was to have 85,000 implants around the world. A system called Turbine promised to allow this procedure to be scaled up to handle millions of implants through automated control. Computer espionage itself could now increasingly be taken out of human hands. Again, computing has changed the scale of what was possible. The elite hackers of GCHQ and the NSA moved beyond simply gathering information. Covert action teams, like Britain's hackers at GCHQ's Joint Threat Research Intelligence Group, JTRIG, have the capacity to deny, disrupt, degrade, or deceive a target online. This might involve taking an opponent's computer offline, or it could involve manipulating information using all the old-fashioned tricks, spreading misinformation or leaking damaging information, stings, infiltrations, ruses. This is what spies have always done, but now they do it online. JTRIG offered a catalogue of effects, saying it could develop others on request. There was apparently also considerable research into psychology to understand how best to influence people online. Whom were these tools used against? One of the few examples to come to light was Operation Cupcake in 2011, when an Al-Qaeda publication offering instructions on bomb-making to would-be jihadists had its content replaced with garbled code which proved to be recipes for cupcakes. Documents suggest some of the techniques, such as discrediting individuals, were for use against people who might be involved in radicalizing others toward violent jihad. Those targets were thought to be particularly vulnerable when their private and public behaviors were not consistent, for instance, by viewing pornography. When exposed, that might undermine their authority and so their ability to spread their message. The honey trap is a staple of espionage. The online version appears to involve getting an individual to go somewhere on the internet or perhaps in real life in pursuit of someone, perhaps a pretty face or the suggestion of one. If spies did this offline in the past, are we comfortable with them doing it online now? Some may recoil from spies ever using these techniques on anybody, online or offline. The question for many others may well come down to who the target is and whether a technique is considered acceptable and proportionate for the kind of danger they represent. That is the central question for all espionage, online or offline. One of the controversial aspects was that some of these techniques were reported as being considered not just against terrorists and the like, but also against groups like Anonymous, a loose collection of hacktivists who disrupt or steal data from corporations and governments they dislike. The members might occasionally be engaged in criminal activity, but they often turn out to be teenagers. The use of high-end techniques against a wider range of targets is one of the issues facing intelligence agencies. For instance, they may be best placed to go after paedophiles who hide on what is known as the dark web using anonymizing tools like Tor and encryption. That may be popular with the public and politicians, but it also takes spies and their advanced capabilities out of the realms of national security. An angry Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook told President Obama that his administration blew it when it defended Prism and other programs by saying they were only used to spy on foreigners. At a White House meeting, Zuckerberg and other tech bosses told the president that they stood to lose billions of dollars. The president had publicly said that the NSA did not spy on Americans. But this did not help much when the majority of your customers were foreigners who had just been told they were fair game. The appearance of their logos on the leaked NSA slides about Prism was a catastrophe for American technology companies, exposing the tension between their global aspirations and American roots. Being an American company was no longer an advantage when your country's spy agency was perceived as exploiting its home field advantage to spy on the world. The revelations were deeply uncomfortable, partly because they showed the companies working to the state, under compulsion, through programs like Prism, but also because of the questions asked of their wider business model of collecting customer information for their own uses, like advertising. Two problems which interrelated. Like the state's spying, that process had not been transparent. The public had traded their own privacy for the convenience offered by tech companies, but were now learning how companies were using this data, and also how the state was taking advantage of corporate acquisitiveness to get hold of the information itself. If the government asked people to carry around a tracking device, they would never do it, but they will happily carry around a phone that can act as a tracking device thanks to the data it emits and which spies can then make use of. How far most people worry about this is debatable, but a pushback against the companies began by privacy activists and some customers. The alliance between companies and cypherpunks that had existed uneasily since the 1990s was broken. Surveillance is the business model of the Internet, cryptographer Bruce Schneier says of the tech company System. Your private thoughts and conversations are the product they sell to their customers. Schneier compared consumers to tenant farmers in medieval Europe who are working on land owned by the big companies to harvest data to make them rich. There was more to come. The anger of tech bosses at the exposure of Prism was serious, but relations nosedived even further when it was revealed that, as well as demanding information from a side door, the NSA was also hacking into the company's internal data links to steal data out of the back. "We were attacked by the Chinese in 2010. We were attacked by the NSA in 2013, Eric Schmidt, chairman of Google, said. A GCHQ operation codenamed Muscular, reported as starting in 2009, collected internal traffic of Yahoo and Google from a point in British territory. Those revelations caused surprise, not just among the tech companies. Why in the world would we burn a relationship with Google by breaking into a data center? One former U.S. intelligence officer said to journalists. Companies felt they had been helping at the front door while being burgled at the back. "We've created a Huawei problem for these companies," said one U.S. official. In other words, American companies would now be met around the world with the kind of suspicion that the Chinese telecoms company encountered in the U.S. And if spies had inserted vulnerabilities in encryption, then people wondered if they might have done the same in other fields of computer technology, whether in software programs or the hardware of chips inside a computer or the routers through which internet traffic passes, something China and Russia had long feared. After all the talk of Chinese backdoors, it was suddenly imported American technical equipment that was being looked at with suspicion. Cisco began to notice an impact on its international sales, including in China. It came out strongly denying that it had worked with the U.S. state to place backdoors or vulnerabilities in its systems that could be exploited. More countries started demanding access to the source code for devices and software used in critical industries in the way Britain had from Huawei. And what of Huawei? There were some in the company who struggled to hide their satisfaction at the fact that the U.S. had been caught out doing exactly what their company had been accused of, although this also increased overall awareness of the possibilities of espionage. In addition, it emerged that the NSA had itself hacked Huawei extensively from at least 2007, obtaining details about its routers and switches. The NSA's Tao was reported as gaining access to Huawei boss Mr. Ren's communications. One of the aims of the spying was to try and establish what links might exist between the company and China's PLA, but another was to be able to carry out surveillance on other countries which were using Huawei kit and to understand how that equipment worked. Understanding how domestic kit worked so it could be spied on was much easier. The revelations provided the perfect justification for China to crack down on U.S. tech companies operating in China, leading to an even greater drive to indigenize software and hardware. Companies like Cisco, IBM, and Microsoft came under renewed pressure as Beijing tried to reduce dependency on their products and pushed new regulations and investigations. Chinese media called on the state to punish American firms for their alleged role in facilitating espionage. Trust in the neutrality of technology began to evaporate as suspicion spread. This was all part of a trend towards what supporters of a free and open system feared was a Balkanized internet, companies and countries wanting to wall themselves off and control access. Countries talked about building their own cables and infrastructure. Germany's Deutsche Telekom was one of those involved in trying to domesticize as much traffic as possible to create a German internet, with packets traveling within the country. Brazil talked of building its own fiber optic cables, which would not go through America or involve American companies. The point of the global internet was that anything could connect to anything else by any route. But that is not set in stone. The internet was beginning to segment into walled gardens run either by companies or by states in which borders were patrolled and those inside needed to identify themselves. An age was passing as a single worldwide web began to fade. Vladimir Putin described the internet as a CIA project in April 2014, signaling his desire to break up U.S. dominance. The global debate on internet governance was shifting. The Russian-Chinese position of more state control was strengthened as other countries came to see the American vision of a multi-stakeholder web as a means for America to maintain dominance, partly through its stakeholders in the form of corporations. Many countries thought their own walled-off, protected internet was preferable to one in which American spies and their corporate allies had free rein. The reaction of many other governments to the PRISM revelations was to say, "We would like a piece of that." Russia has always had less access to global traffic flows than the US and UK because cables do not pass through it. This is one reason it has focused more on cyber espionage to gather intelligence. However, it does have strong control over the domestic environment. The FSB's SOARM, System of Operative Investigative Measures, has its own direct access to phone and internet providers in every region, allowing information to be collected and stored. Putin criticized a major Russian search engine for basing its servers overseas, and Russia's parliament passed a law in 2014 requiring foreign social media websites to keep their servers in Russia and save user information for 6 months. This would allow the Russians to demand access to systems in the way PRISM had done for the US. Localizing data storage was something states pushed for since it gave their law enforcement and spies more chance of getting at the information. India's $4 billion central monitoring system provided direct access to phone and online activity, reportedly including automatic voice print recognition against the traffic. One blog said the Indian government made PRISM look like the paragon of restraint, especially since there was reported to be relatively little oversight over the way it was used. German intelligence told its parliament it needed more money for its real-time and automated monitoring of the Internet so that it could catch up with the NSA and GCHQ, and that if it did not get it, it would fall behind others like Spain and Italy. Countries approached technology companies and telecoms providers and said that if they did not cooperate, then laws would be passed forcing them to collect and retain data and provide it if required. Companies take different positions about how far they cooperate with this based on their corporate position, relative power, and view of a country's behavior, but they found more and more countries demanding more and more data. Rather than hasten the demise of the system he despised, Edward Snowden's disclosures may have inadvertently led to the acceleration of its spread in other countries seeking to emulate the US and UK. British and American spies talked about a second golden age for signals intelligence in the post-9/11 era. But was it a short-lived one? Edward Snowden may have exposed their power, but deeper trends were also complicating their work. The challenges are manifold. Home field advantage is not what it was as the center of gravity for the Internet shifted. Asia was rising. By 2014, the amount of international Internet traffic touching the US and UK had nearly halved. "We won't see this traffic crossing the UK. Oh dear," one person wrote in a paper before asking whether GCHQ should do the same as the US, which involved buying up real estate in these places, apparently Asia. As well as cable traffic, concerns over PRISM meant countries were less willing to store their data in the US or with US companies. China had already built up its own consumer rivals to Google and Twitter. Playing a leading role in developing the Internet allowed the US to export its values, import other countries' information through spying, and make a lot of money for American corporations along the way. But that era may now be passing. Companies like Huawei were on the rise. Then there was the speed of technological innovation. During the Cold War, the communications devices the West was trying to intercept changed very infrequently. Keeping up with slow Soviet development and procurement cycles was easy. Keeping up with the pace of commercially driven innovation was far more challenging. Issues of accountability and transparency are also challenging espionage. It may be possible to get companies to be more open about how they use data in order to ensure informed consent from the public, but that is trickier with spying since revealing its capability can undermine its effectiveness. But this creates a complex quandary for spying in the world of computer-based espionage. I used to say when I was director of NSA that to be effective, NSA really needs to be only two things, powerful and secret, Michael Hayden observes. And we exist inside a political culture that frankly only distrusts two things, power and secrecy. It was precisely the desire for power and secrecy that worried critics of the spy agency. There had been too much of both, they felt. After he left the NSA, Hayden ran the CIA. He asked his advisory board to look at a number of questions, including one broad issue. Can America continue to conduct espionage in a society that every day demands more transparency and more public accountability from every aspect of national life? The study remains classified, but Hayden did give a short summary of its conclusion. The answer is we don't know. How much risk do we want, and what level of security do we consider proportionate to the threats we face? That trade-off is a deeply political, even personal judgment. The harder question is how to even make that decision when so much of the information is secret, because making it public would risk compromising its effectiveness. Squaring this circle in democratic societies is a major challenge. The conundrum of how to watch the watchers has always been a problem for the secret world. Optimists believe transparency and data will mean that the screens Orwell depicted in 1984, his dystopian novel about authoritarian power, could be used not just to surveil us, but could also become two-way. Government secrecy is under pressure in a similar manner to individual privacy, as Snowden himself exemplified. Despite being subject to hostile cyber attacks, the tiny Baltic state of Estonia shows some signs of how this might work. It has pioneered moving government services online. Using a national identity card and a digital signature, citizens can access some 4,000 services from voting through banking to filing taxes, as well as accessing medical records and ordering prescriptions. The benefits are clear for the public, who can access all their data at will, and also for the state. But it can only query the databases that it needs and not cross-reference them. The key safeguard is an audit trail. Every query about someone's data is recorded on a log file that the individual can see, with criminal liability for anyone who accesses data they should not. I feel more like I am the big brother who is watching what the state is doing, an Estonian claims. Estonia points to a form of mutual surveillance in the world of pervasive data in which citizens are able to use technology and surveillance to watch their state as it watches them. Just as police now regularly film protesters at demonstrations to track them, so protesters now also film the police to catch signs of abuse. The "if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear" argument is being turned back on the state. A panopticon in which everyone watches everyone else is one possible future, although some believe that the mere possibility of being watched in itself leads to changes in behavior and will undermine the freedom of both state and individual. Audit trails may work for most types of data, but are harder for national security and intelligence information agencies, for whom the problem of not tipping off a target remains. Spies say secret services need to keep some secrets or else they're useless. But which ones? And who gets to decide? Transparency and accountability in these fields requires different and technically savvy mechanisms of oversight. But people's attitude will often revolve around a simple question: how much do you trust your state? Your answer may be very different depending on who you are and in which state you live. In his farewell speech at GCHQ, Ian Lobban launched an attack on the ideology that suffused the thinking of cypherpunks, Snowden, as well as parts of Silicon Valley. For its most ardent supporters, the internet was a symbol of freedom and liberation from the confines of traditional authority. They had argued that the state, and especially spies, were the serpent in the Garden of Eden. Lobban demurred. "We all know that the beautiful dream of the internet as a totally ungoverned space was just that, a beautiful dream," he argued. "Like all utopian visions, it was flawed because it failed to account for the persistence of the worst aspects of human nature. Alongside the amazing benefits, there are the plotters, the proliferators, and the pedophiles. From what we know of ungoverned spaces in the real world, do we really believe that the world would be a better place if the internet becomes an ungoverned space where anybody can act freely with impunity?" For law enforcement agencies and spies, the internet was no paradise, but a place, like any other, where the bad congregated and communicated. It was an ungoverned space which they felt could not be left alone, which meant piercing the veil of anonymity that the internet and encryption offered. The advocates of privacy and internet freedom counter that the ecosystem of the internet is far more fragile than is often understood, and that the spies have done more than police the Garden of Eden and have too often been the snake. A dozen uniformed police in riot gear smashed their way into a terraced house on a quiet street in Shepherd's Bush, West London, in late 2005. After a scuffle with a young man, they found his laptop was still switched on at his desk. He was logged in under the name IRH007 and working on a website called You Bomb It. It took a few weeks for detectives to realize they had caught one of the world's most wanted cyber jihadists, a man whose real identity had been unknown, but who went by the name Irhabi, or Terrorist 007, a strange tribute to James Bond that reflected the mixed-up pop culture references of a new generation of extremists. YouTube had not been founded when Yunis Tsuli was first talent-spotted by Al-Qaeda in Iraq to spread its videos. He still needed to convert formats and then hack websites in order to upload and host films showing their violence. But a decade later, the next generation fighting in Iraq and Syria would take the use of social media and the internet to a new level. That would heighten the tension between spies and companies. On his first day in the job in November 2014, the new GCHQ director, Robert Hannigan, launched a blistering salvo. The group calling itself Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL, was, he wrote, the first terrorist group whose members have grown up on the internet and whose members were adept at using technology to communicate and organize, as well as exploiting social media to spread fear and radicalize and recruit. The rise of ISIS and its aggressive use of social media threw many of the tensions over the internet and espionage into sharp relief, and with it the question of whose priorities and values, the state or the tech companies, would predominate. Hannigan accused American technology companies of being in denial at the way they had become the command and control networks of choice for terrorists and criminals. He called for greater support and cooperation from those companies, a move that was greeted with some incredulity from parts of the tech sector who argued they were doing and would continue to do what they had to do by law. But in the post-Snowden world, those companies were becoming more resistant to government demands to hand over customer data, positioning themselves as champions of the user and privacy, and increasing their use of encryption. This led to bitter rows. In 2011, GCHQ had flagged up an individual showing interest in extremist material online. The lead was assigned to an MI5 team whose job was to investigate further using digital intelligence to try to work out who they were, what they were up to, and if they were a threat to national security. The power of jihadist media material made those kinds of leads increasingly important. The online Al-Qaeda magazine Inspire, for instance, which called for lone wolf attacks and provided instructions, was, MI5 claimed, read by those involved in at least 7 out of the 10 attacks planned within the UK since it first appeared in 2010. The person who had been spotted in 2011, Michael Adebowale, was assessed as not being a major threat. Eventually, a warrant for more intrusive surveillance went up to a minister in May 2013. But within hours of the warrant being sent, Adebowale and another man who had also crossed MI5's radar mowed down a soldier, Lee Rigby, with a car in Woolwich and brutally killed him with a knife. A British intelligence oversight report into the killing in November 2014 lashed out at American tech companies, arguing the only lead which might have stopped the killing of Rigby was a message in which Adebowale had talked graphically with a known extremist about wanting to kill a soldier. The committee said this was not passed on by the company, in this case, Facebook. But whose job was it to spy on the content of people's private messages sent on Facebook? The companies or the states? The companies were nervous of a system in which they would have to scan all their customers' data and then proactively report suspicious content to governments. This would effectively mean the act of spying, and not just the collection of data, had been outsourced to the private sector. That was not just technically challenging, but also awkward when it came to winning over their customers' trust. And which states would they report this to, and how would they define extremist content? The UK government pushed for companies to retain data so it was available for the state, and also for companies to agree to implement warrants for people's data and communications, even if those companies were based abroad or kept the data abroad. The US pushed for the same. Companies resisted cooperating on anything more than a voluntary basis, fearing Russia and China would be next to make the demand. In the first half of 2014, Google received almost 15,000 government requests for user data from around the world, complying in 65% of cases. It increased its use of encryption as well to ensure governments had to approach at the front door to get hold of user data. In terms of challenges for the spies, the oldest remained the most fundamental: secret codes. An encrypted future may be arriving as companies and people seek to protect their communications and data from hackers and prying eyes. This is becoming the central battleground, and again raises tensions between the corporate world and governments. Robert Hannigan of GCHQ and other spy chiefs have begun sounding the alarm on the spread of encryption. Companies are deploying encryption both on consumer products and across corporate networks, positioning themselves as protecting their customers' data against a range of threats. Apple in 2014 made a point of saying it did not hold the keys to decrypt its new iPhone, leading to a row with the FBI. Ubiquitous encryption can protect information from criminals, hackers, spies, and also states, including your own. There is no encryption system that keeps the Chinese government out, but that lets local law enforcement have access to that data, Christopher Segoyan of the American Civil Liberties Union argues. With encryption, you either keep everyone out or you keep no one out. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? The inherent tension of the crypto wars remains unresolved. Can the defensive value of guaranteed protection and privacy be offset against the cost to law enforcement and spies of not being able to reach their targets, whoever they might be? Encryption might force spies to do more traditional espionage in terms of bugging, burgling, and endpoint computer attacks, rather than relying on passively intercepting data using their global system. But is that a good thing? The familiar fear of the spies that they are about to go dark and that encryption is going to super-empower individuals is matched by the fear of privacy activists that the state is taking us to an Orwellian future of pervasive surveillance. Let us speak no more of faith in man, but bind him down from mischief by the chains of cryptography, Edward Snowden proclaimed. For him, encryption had the power to bind the state and to empower the individual, altering the fundamental balance of power between the two. The state and its spies, unsurprisingly, did not want to be bound.